Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking a deep plunge into something really core to the American identity, you know, like baseball, apple pie, and hard work.
Absolutely, it's foundational.
But lately, well, especially after the pandemic just shook everything up, the whole conversation around work-life balance has completely exploded.
Mm.
It really makes you ask, what does hard work even mean today?
It's a fair question. The landscape has shifted so much.
So our mission today is to unpack this fascinating history of the American workweek.
Mm.
We'll look at how it's changed, why it's being reexamined so intensely now, and you know what it means for you, for everyone in today's workforce.
Because it's definitely not one size fits all anymore.
Not at all.
And it's important to say up front, this is complex. There's historical ambiguity. Things aren't always clear cut.
Right.
But we've gathered a lot of historical accounts, economic data, some really interesting recent studies, too.
Yeah.
We'll touch on everything from, say, manufacturing hours way back in the 1800s to these modern experiments you hear about, like in New Zealand and Iceland.
Okay, sounds great. So let's start way back. Early 1800s, you mentioned 70-hour weeks.
Yeah, or even more. It wasn't uncommon at all.
Especially for farmers, right? Working sun up to sundown.
Exactly. And often the whole idea of tracking hours just wasn't there. Work and life, work and play.
Mm.
Very fuzzy lines.
Even earlier, like colonial times, during peak labor periods, they saw 8 to 10 hours a day as just necessary.
It's hard to imagine that 70-hour week today managing family,
right,
life.
Definitely blurs those work-life boundaries we think about now.
It really does. And what's interesting, even as the movement to shorten the week started in the 19th century, some historians argue hours might have actually increased for some workers then.
Really? How so?
Well, it just highlights how tough it is to measure accurately back then, especially in farming, before detailed records became common.
Gotcha. Okay, but then manufacturing takes off and things start to get clearer.
Yes, we see more concrete data. Manufacturing hours specifically started dropping, like from around 69 hours a week in 1830.
Wow.
Down to about 60 by 1890. And then the 20th century saw even bigger drops.
Right. You mentioned going from about 58 and a half hours in 1900 down to under 40 by the late 80s.
Yeah, 39.2 hours by 1988. A huge decline.
So what drove those big drops?
Major events were key. World War I, the Great Depression. These had massive impacts on work availability and demand.
Makes sense. Factories closing, less work.
Exactly. But it was really after World War II that things sort of settled. They stabilized around 40 hours. That became the norm.
But there was this interesting point in the 1920s, right? The push for shorter hours kind of faded when the week was around 50 hours.
It did, for a bit. But then pressure started building again by the late 20s.
And then Henry Ford steps in.
Yeah.
1926, the 5-day work week. That seems like a huge moment. Why was his decision so impactful?
It was pivotal. Ford showed a major corporation could thrive on a shorter week. It gave the idea massive legitimacy.
So it wasn't just talk anymore.
Right. And that momentum fed directly into something really foundational for workers today, the Fair Labor Standards Act, the FSLA.
Okay, well, what did that do exactly?
Well, it set the national minimum wage, which was huge. But crucially for this discussion, it mandated overtime pay time and a half for work over 40 hours a week.
Ah, so that financially locked in the 40-hour standard.
Precisely. It changed the whole incentive structure for employers.
So bringing us to today, the work weeks officially hovered around 40 hours, slowly dropping maybe, but basically stable. Most people seem okay with it.
On the surface, maybe, but you definitely hear those murmurs, right? People feeling they don't have enough free time, even at 40 hours.
Yeah. Is it really efficient or just what we're used to, a historical habit?
That's the million-dollar question now, isn't it?
Which leads us perfectly into the modern era. We're seeing companies, startups, even old-school ones, rethinking that 40-hour standard. What lit the fuse?
Oh, the pandemic, without a doubt. It just uprooted the workforce for nearly everyone. Flexibility wasn't a perk anymore. It was suddenly a necessity.
Right. And those stats are wild. Only 6% working from home before.
Mm-hmm. And 3/4 had never done it.
Then, bam, May 2020, a third of workers are remote.
It was a massive, unplanned, real-world experiment. Force upon us, really.
But this idea of flexibility, it wasn't totally brand new, was it? You mentioned an example from the 70s.
Yeah, that Gladstone, Missouri wastewater crew.
Mm.
Really interesting. They moved to 4 10-hour days.
And what happened?
Services improved, sick leave went down, overtime dropped, productivity went up.
So even back then, it showed the 9-to-5 wasn't the only way.
Exactly. It challenged that universal assumption.
And now employees are really demanding it. Over half looking to switch schedules.
51%, according to studies. And what's really striking is that flexibility often ranks higher than wages or unlimited leave.
Wow. More important than pay for many.
It's a huge driver.
Yeah.
Of course, it's not simple. Flex time tends to reduce turnover and absenteeism.
Good for business.
But things like night shifts can have the opposite effect. Higher absenteeism, lower productivity. It's a complex balance, especially for 247 operations.
So the demand is clear. But how do companies actually do this? Especially smaller ones. Harvard Business Review had those four questions.
Right. Those are good starting points for employers. Like, are your current schedules harming well-being?
Mm-hmm.
Can you match personalities to non-traditional roles? Is real flexibility letting employees have some say in when and how they work actually possible?
And crucially, can the business sustain it?
Those are the tough, practical questions leaders need to grapple with. And it's not just an American issue. Think about Australia.
Right. The first country with a 40-hour week. A worker's paradise, you said.
They were heralded as leaders, but now they face the same pressures as the U.S., people feeling overworked, underpaid.
So the 9-to-5 is getting a rethink globally.
It really is. It seems systemic.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit. What about the people who don't have flexibility? The essential workers during the pandemic really highlighted this.
Absolutely. Retail, medical, they often felt incredibly vulnerable.
And that statistic, nearly 40% of workers not knowing their schedule, until just days before.
It's staggering. Imagine trying to arrange childcare or take a class or just plan your life like that. The effects are genuinely harmful.
Creates huge instability.
Mm-hmm.
So is anything being done policy-wise?
Well, we're seeing some efforts. Places like Oregon, New York, Seattle, San Francisco are trying to mandate predictable scheduling practices.
But it's early days for that research.
It is. Still pretty new. But you also see some interesting things on a smaller scale, like those vet clinics offering 4 11-hour days.
And that works well for them.
Apparently, yeah. High staff satisfaction, good for the business. It shows potential, even if it's not widespread.
But there's a clear disparity, isn't there? Less educated workers are more likely to have these unpredictable schedules.
That's a major finding. It's really an equity issue, not just about convenience.
Definitely. And when you break it down by different groups, the challenges look different. Like single workers, childless couples.
Right. There's often this unspoken assumption they have no outside life. They can just work constantly.
And they might get passed over for promotion?
It happens. Remember that Janet Napolitano example? A governor saying, she has no family. Perfect. She can devote 19, 20 hours a day.
Wow. That says a lot about ingrained attitudes.
It really does. Then think about women working part-time.
Yeah.
Some sources show they choose lower pay to keep capacity for caregiving or other pursuits, precisely because full-time roles lack the needed flexibility.
So it's a conscious trade-off driven by inflexible structures.
Often, yes. And for single parents or guardians, the scheduling problems are just immense.
That 66% to 90% figure you mentioned, whose hours differ week to week.
It's shocking. It really points towards exploitation, frankly. Employers demanding constant flexibility from the worker without giving much back.
So leadership needs to find non-traditional solutions there.
Urgently. And even for two-parent working families, the impact of non-standard schedules on kids is becoming clearer.
Right, those cognitive and behavioral outcomes.
Mm.
Lower skills in toddlers.
Yes, and parents missing school events, feeling stressed, anxious, which can then affect the children too.
So policymakers are being asked to create what? Disincentives for employers.
Exactly. Things like maybe higher pay for unpredictable hours or mandating genuinely predictable schedules, sufficient rest time, making it easier for parents to plan and be present.
And what about unions? They seem to be playing a bigger role lately.
They are, definitely. You see it with Starbucks, Amazon. Pushing for better work-life balance is a priority.
Lots of resolutions, negotiations.
Yes, though it's tough fighting against longstanding cultures of, you know, extreme dedication in some fields.
But younger members are pushing back.
That's an interesting shift, yes. They're questioning that always-on expectation. But surprisingly, there isn't a ton of research specifically on work-life balance within union contexts. That needs more study.
Okay, let's talk proof. Experiments. That 1974 study sounds fascinating, comparing a 5-day week with a 4-day, 10-hour week.
It was really ahead of its time, and the results were, well, surprising back then.
What did they find?
A big jump in overall job satisfaction for the 4-day group. They felt better about pay, socializing, job security.
Okay, so far so good.
But here's the twist. This happened without them feeling more autonomous or self-actualized at work, and some actually reported more anxiety, likely from the longer days.
Huh. So satisfaction went up, despite some drawbacks.
Exactly. It suggests that having more free time, that extra day off, was incredibly powerful in itself. Oh, and absenteeism didn't really change significantly, which flew in the face of predictions.
Interesting. Some found the long days harder.
Yes, more physically strenuous was the phrase used. But overall, the net effect was a significant improvement in overall satisfaction.
That really sets the stage for the more recent trials, doesn't it? New Zealand? Iceland?
It does. Take Perpetual Guardian in New Zealand, that estate management firm. 2018 four-day week trial.
How'd that go?
So successful, management is seeking to make the change permanent. That says it all, really.
What were the specifics? Lower stress.
Lower stress, better job performance reported by staff. Metrics like leadership, commitment, teamwork all went up.
Wow.
And a key factor, they really involved employees in planning the change. It wasn't just top down.
Collaboration was key. And then Iceland. That seems even bigger. 86% of the workforce.
It's massive. Around 200,000 people moving from 40 hours down to 35 or 36.
A whole societal shift.
Truly. And the results. Workers are happier. Production hasn't suffered. It's even increased in some sectors.
How did that happen? Was it government led?
It was pushed hard by unions and grassroots groups, actually, responding to data showing Iceland lagged behind Nordic neighbors on work-life balance.
And it covered all sorts of jobs.
All sorts. Daycares, hospitals, police, government offices, museums, you name it.
What kind of practical changes did they make?
One really notable one was just replacing a lot of meetings with emails or other digital comms. Simple, but apparently effective for efficiency.
Replacing meetings with emails.
Mm.
Music to many ears, I bet.
Hmm.
So, looking forward, what's next? What do we need to study more?
Well, that link between scheduling and employee health and well-being seems crucial.
Yeah.
And it raises this bigger question. Should flexible scheduling be seen as a formal benefit, like health insurance or tuition help?
Is it currently?
Not really. Based on the research, there's very little qualitative work framing it that way. But maybe it should be. We need to explore how to structure that professionally.
How to incentivize it without leaving certain workers behind.
Exactly. How do we make flexibility a standard consideration, not just a perk for some? That needs real innovation and focus going forward, especially given the clear wellness benefits.
Okay, so wrapping up this deep dive. Mm-hmm. It's crystal clear the work week isn't set in stone. It never really was.
Far from it.
And the pandemic definitely hit the accelerator, forcing us to question that traditional 40-hour model. Is it a relic? Is it still relevant?
The answer is definitely getting more complicated, isn't it?
It is.
And look, some jobs just won't allow for radical flexibility. That's the reality. But even then, good leadership, real vision. It can still mean offering other perks, giving workers more input into their schedules.
Which benefits everyone in the end.
Right. Better well-being for employees, better productivity and retention for employers. It's potentially a win-win.
So the final thought for you, our listener.
Yeah.
Given everything we've uncovered, what does a truly well-adjusted work-life balance look like now? Especially in a world where flexibility feels less like a bonus and more like a fundamental need for well-being, and maybe even for productivity itself.
Something to chew on.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Something to think about until our next deep dive.